The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
What do you want to?
Hello, my name is Patty Dalai. I'm a professor of international trade law here at the American University Washington College of Law. And I want to welcome you all to our law school. It's my pleasure to have this meeting here. I would like to very much thank, first and foremost, Aluzio for hosting this and basically telling me about APCI and giving us the opportunity to host you here. I want to thank our speaker, Mr. Bruce Wilson, for giving us his time and joining us here. I am also currently the acting director of the International Legal Studies Program, which some of you, I see some of my, some of our hardcore trade students here, LLM students here, and JD students, and some of our graduates. We have a very active international trade law society at the law school. We also have one of the largest LLM programs in the country that always ranks at the top six or so, which has got a specialization in free trade and regional trade agreements, as well as international trade law, international business law, and we've had the good fortune to have Aluzio teach in the course with Adriana Vito. I also want to thank Adriana for all the time she's spent in organizing this conference. With your permission, I'm just going to briefly say something about Mr. Wilson for those of you students that may not know. Bruce Wilson is holds a BA in history from Stanford, MA in international relations from Johns Hopkins, and an MBA with specialization in finance and JD from George Washington. He assumed the post of Director of Legal Affairs Division of the WTO on 16th of September 2002. In this post, he serves as the principal legal officer of the organization, a post in which he spends much of his time on WTO dispute settlement matters, which is the topic today. Prior to taking up his position, he held a number of different trade policy positions in the U.S. government, at the Office of U.S. Trade Representative, and the Committee on Ways and Means of the U.S. House of Representatives. I also would like to introduce Aluzio to our students. Those of you at ABCI, of course, know him. He's the chairman of ABCI. He's also adjunct professor at American University Washington College of Law, economic advisor at the Embassy of Brazil in Washington, and a Brazilian government-appointed member of the Permanent List of Trade Remedy Experts prepared to take part in the WTO Dispute Settlement Panel. A trade policy specialist with over 25 years of experience, serving 8 Brazilian ambassadors in Washington, has been assisting with the Brazilian government in bilateral and multilateral trade negotiations in over 80 trade remedy cases and countless reviews of anti-dumping and countervailing duties. He coordinates the Brazilian Embassy's trade policy training program, which provides theoretical and practical training to professionals from the government and private sector on international trade policy. He was a major contributor to drafting of Brazilian trade laws and regulations. I also want to say that he does have a degree from American University, but not from the law school, but from the main campus, the economics office. So we do have ownership of him in some way at AU. Without further ado, I'm going to give it to Aluzio to talk about ABCI a little bit to our students, maybe a few minutes before we have Bruce start. I want to tell you that it's a particular privilege of mine to get to know this institute. I've always been impressed with the Brazilian trade folks. Those of us who have been doing research in the area have always been talking amongst ourselves about how always well-trained the Brazilian trade lawyers are, and they're an impressive role model, and I just found out why. One of the reasons is attributable to your efforts. So, without further ado, sending it to you.
Well, thank you, Paldea. It's an honor for me to be here. It's an honor for me to teach here, and I'd also like to thank you for hosting us today. This is the 89th meeting of ABCI, and every time I say that, you know, we've been planning on what the party is going to be when we reach 100. So hopefully we'll be able to get a big party going when we get to that side. We started a little bit late, so I'm not going to delay too much. I want you all to visit ABCI's website. It's abciinstitute.org. All the explanation is there. Suffice to say that our objective is to enhance the teaching of international trade policy to all young professionals that want to specialize in that area. So that's our main objective, and we do everything in terms of seminars and every mean that we can use to divulge and make the information available to everyone, we use. And includes publications, includes international seminars, and our regular meetings. So I also like to thank Bruce for making room in his agenda to be here today. We have known each other for a number of years, and it's my pleasure to have him come back again to ABCI. Is your second?
My second visit.
Yeah, your second visit. Yeah. So thank you, Bruce, and the floor is yours.
Well, thank you, Aloisio, and good morning, everyone. Couple of comments. First of all, on my legal staff in the WTO, I have a graduate of the Washington College of Law, Chris Clinton. I don't know if you know Chris.
Yes.
Did you? Okay. So we have a graduate from this law school on the legal staff. And I also have a Brazilian lawyer on my staff, Lauro Lax, from Florianópolis. So ABCI and Paulo Bentes is on the appellate body staff, another Brazilian lawyer. And I think both Lauro and Pablo are members of ABCI.
Pablo is.
Well, we'll get Lauro.
Well, we'll get Lauro.
We'll get Lauro to be there. But this is the second time, as Aloisio said, that I've been able to speak to ABCI. And this is actually the first time I've ever been here at the Washington College of Law. So it's a pleasure to get to know Padide and her program here. I know the program by its reputation, the International Legal Studies program here, has a fine reputation. The subject this morning is dispute settlement in the WTO. We're not going to be here for the next few weeks to discuss this. We've only got maybe an hour this morning. So I think what I will do is, because it's such a vast subject, I'll just limit my introductory remarks, and then there are probably things that you would like to focus on in particular. Maybe the Brazilians would like to focus on the appellate body selection that was announced yesterday. I don't know.
Maybe not.
But I was not involved in that process at all. So
So you're still my friend.
I noted that announcement yesterday as well. As most of you probably know something about WTO dispute settlement, I don't really have to talk too much about the basics, but one of the things I would like to say in terms of the WTO secretariat and how many lawyers we have in the secretariat, just to give you some sense, that may at one time or another work on dispute settlement, both in the WTO secretariat and in the appellate body secretariat. We have about a dozen lawyers, 12 lawyers in the legal affairs division, and we staff all of the non-trade remedy cases. And then the rules division probably has another dozen lawyers, and they staff all the trade remedy cases. And then we have lawyers in the functional divisions around the Secretariat, intellectual property services in particular, that will provide lawyers with specialized expertise in those areas if the dispute involves that subject matter. And then we have lawyers in some of the other divisions as well. So by my count, roughly, I would say at one time or another, there may be 40 different lawyers in the Secretariat and the Appellate Body Secretariat, which operates separately and independently from the WTO, that work on dispute settlement in the WTO, as well as other individuals, economists and so forth, that will be called in on individual cases. So it's not only the legal affairs division that is involved in this, but other divisions as well. As you probably know, the treaty that governs dispute settlement in the WTO is the Treaty on Dispute Settlement, the Dispute Settlement Understanding, which largely codified and improved and modified GATT dispute settlement law and practice. I think it's generally acknowledged by our 153 members that the WTO dispute settlement system has operated reasonably well in the first nearly 15 years of its existence. Some of the jurisprudence, of course, as is the case with any judicial system, is not without controversy, and I'm sure you're aware of some of the cases that have provoked controversy, particularly in this town, but also in other capitals around the world. But by and large, our members are reasonably satisfied with the way dispute settlement in the WTO operates. As you know, you can break the dispute settlement process into four stages in the WTO: mandatory consultations, then the panel stage, where we have ad hoc three-person panels to hear and decide cases, then the appellate phase, and about 70% of all panel and compliance or panel reports get appealed. Arbitrations over level of retaliation are not appealable, so the appellate body does not hear appeals of those. And of course, right now we have a very high profile arbitration going on in the Brazilian cotton case, which our Brazilian friends are, I'm sure, following quite closely. And that decision, that arbitral award, will come out in the coming weeks. And that will be looked at very closely, both in Brazil and in Washington. And then the fourth stage of dispute settlement is the implementation or compliance stage. Once an adverse decision comes out of the adjudicatory process, a member is given a reasonable period of time to comply. And if compliance is not achieved, then that has implications either with respect to a retaliation or further negotiations to resolve the matter. But I think oftentimes when one looks at the dispute settlement system in the WTO, the focus tends to be on the panel or the appellate stage, but there is a lot of activity after these decisions have been rendered during the compliance phase, because if a country doesn't comply, or if there is a dispute over the compliance with an adverse decision, then that matter can go back into litigation in a compliance panel, as you know, and probably one out of every four cases there is a disagreement over compliance and it will go back into a compliance panel proceeding. Usually before it ever goes into arbitration. The WTO dispute settlement system, as you know, is not a purely judicial system. It's what I call a hybrid system. There are political aspects as well as judicial aspects to it. So one of the debates that goes on in the dispute settlement negotiations is the extent to which we should move to a more judicialized system or away from what we have right now to a more member control system. In particular, this is a debate that goes on between the European community, who would like to move the system to a more judicialized system, have permanent panelists, have a uniform set of procedures at the panel level, as opposed to the Americans, who would like to move a little bit more toward member control in the system. Some of that is a reaction to some of the decisions that came out in the trade remedy area. But there's this tension between some of the key litigants as to how the system should continue to evolve. Maybe I'll say a little bit about that later on. If you look at the usage of the system in the first 14 plus years, you've probably seen these statistics, but it's worth noting that To date, we've had 392 disputes brought to the WTO since 1995. Of those 92 disputes that have been initiated, a little less than half have actually gone into litigation at the panel stage, which means that this compulsory consultation phase in WTO dispute settlement is more than perfunctory in terms of its function. That is, there is a lot that is achieved through compulsory consultations. The numbers indicate that, and the notification by members of mutually agreed solutions to disputes that have come about as a result of consultations in this mandatory consultation phase show that that is a very important, that mandatory consultation period is a very important feature of the system, because it does result in mutually agreed solutions. It does result in outcomes to disputes that have been initiated that do not require litigation in the system. Initially, I think there was some skepticism as to whether a mandatory consultation period would mean anything, but I think the skeptics have been proven wrong by the experience we've had so far to date in the system. As I said, a little less than half of the disputes that have been initiated have gone into litigation in the system to date. So far, we have had 142 panels that have been composed that have heard or are in the process of hearing 175 different disputes. There have been other panels that have been established but never composed because the parties came to a mutually satisfactory solution after the dispute settlement body established the panel, but before it was composed. For those of you who may not know what I'm talking about, the dispute settlement body, which is the political body that oversees the operation of the system, has the authority, the exclusive authority to establish panels. But once a panel is established in the WTO, because the panels themselves are ad hoc three-person panels, we have to go into a composition process to actually compose those panels. The Secretariat, working with the parties, identifies individuals that meet the criteria, the desired criteria by the parties to the case, to hear the case at the panel level. So I spend a lot of my time, well, when panels have been established, working with the parties to the dispute in identifying individuals to compose these panels to at the first level. The panels, in essence, operate as trial courts to actually adjudicate the dispute. The fail-safe mechanism under the dispute settlement understanding, if the parties cannot come to agreement over who should hear the case, is a provision which allows either party of the dispute, but usually the complaining party, to ask the Director General to compose the panel. This ensures that you don't have endless delays in getting the adjudicatory body up and running to hear the dispute. And there is a 20-day time limit that has to or 20 days have to pass after the panel has been established before either party can ask the Director General to compose a panel. But in practice, we will go through maybe two or three slates of names as potential panelists before the complaining party will ask the Director General to compose either in whole or in part the panel. A lot of times the parties can agree on one or two of the adjudicators and will ask the Director General to intervene and fill out the panel. So the Director General is, when he's composing panels, he is not necessarily naming all three of the panelists. Maybe it's one, maybe it's two, maybe it's three. As I said, the Director General usually is involved in about 60% of all panel compositions. Now, that is the exclusive function that the Director General has in dispute settlement. This is a very non-politicized process. The only time the Director General gets involved in dispute settlement is when he is asked to compose panels. After the panel has been composed, the Director General will hear about the panel proceeding is when the panel report is issued. At the same time, the parties hear, the Director General will hear. So the Director General has no role whatsoever in the adjudicatory process other than in panel composition, or in the rather infrequent event that he will be asked to provide his good offices in a particular dispute or to mediate. Now, there have only been very few cases where the Director General has been asked by the parties to provide his good offices in a dispute. Last year, in the bananas dispute involving the European communities and a number of Latin American banana exporters, the Director General was asked to provide his good offices to see whether or not he could facilitate a resolution of the bananas dispute. And Director General Lemie provided good offices for maybe up to 8 months last year, held 38 different meetings with the parties, made some progress, but they were on the verge of getting an agreement which broke down. The potential agreement broke down last summer over its relationship with the tropical products negotiation in the Doha round. So at that point, the talks broke off, and the Director General has not been involved any further in that particular dispute, although the negotiations in that long-running bananas dispute have been resumed. It is my hope, because we've had several compliance panels, as well as a number of initial panels in that dispute, that the parties can finally negotiate a settlement here so we don't have to have additional litigation in the WTO in that dispute. If, as you know, a party does not comply with an adverse ruling, eventually the remedy in the WTO is retaliation. Now, even though the dispute settlement understanding in the way it's constructed is a so-called compliance, compensation, retaliation model, in practice, I think compensation in the event of noncompliance is only being given one time. So in practice, the model operates as a compliance / retaliation model. And surprisingly enough, because the overall compliance record of members with adverse decisions of the WTO has been very positive, we've had very few instances of retaliation in the WTO dispute settlement system to date. In fact, there have been only 10 instances where retaliation was requested and authorized, and every time that complaining party has won a case in the WTO and has been authorized to retaliate, the responding party has asked that the level of retaliation be the subject of arbitration, as is currently the case in the Brazil case against the U.S. on cotton subsidies. And even though in 10 instances where we've had those arbitrations, the DSB has gone ahead and authorized the parties at issue to retaliate. In fact, only 4 cases has retaliation actually been imposed. In the bananas case, the beef hormones case, U.S. versus EC, back in the late, both of those were in the late 90s. In the EC's case against the U.S., on the FISC, the Foreign Sales Corporation, where the EC actually began to impose retaliation, And ultimately, in 2004, the U.S. Congress repealed the FISC. And then the other case where there was retaliation was in the Byrd Amendment case, once again involving a U.S. Law in which dumping and countervailing duties were remitted to the petitioning parties. That was found to be a violation of WTO law. Ultimately, the U.S. Congress repealed the Byrd Amendment, and the retaliation was lifted in part because there are still some residual issues there having to do with collection of unliquidated duties on imports that entered before the effective date of the repeal. But that's a detail. Now, who uses the WTO dispute settlement system? Well, it's not a surprise, probably, that the both the biggest traders and some of the politically most important members are the ones that are most active in dispute settlement. At the stage of litigation, the United States is either a complaining or responding party 60% in all panel proceedings. The European Communities is a complaining or responding party in maybe 40 to 45% of all cases. And then there are probably 10 other members that are continually active in dispute settlement, either as a complaining or responding party. And these are both developed and developing countries. So we have about a dozen members that are constantly engaged in dispute settlement on a regular basis. Besides the U.S. and EC, of course, Brazil is very active in dispute settlement, Argentina, Chile, Canada, Mexico. The interesting thing about Mexico and Canada, the U.S. and their trading relationship is, notwithstanding NAFTA, they tend to resolve disputes other than trade, well, even trade remedy disputes, notwithstanding Chapter 19 mechanism. They tend to resort to the WTO to resolve disputes amongst themselves, notwithstanding the existence of a dispute settlement mechanism under NAFTA. But one of the reasons the dispute settlement system under NAFTA doesn't work is because there is no fail-safe mechanism for composing the adjudicatory body like we have in the WTO. So under Chapter 20, I think, of NAFTA, when they go into dispute settlement, the responding party can basically effectively block the establishment or composition of the panel because there's no time limits. There's no mechanism to compose a panel after a certain period of time. So Mexico and Canada and the U.S. go at it in the WTO all the time. What's the nature of the cases that are brought into the WTO? As you know, the corpus of WTO law consists of 16 different multilateral agreements and two plurilateral agreements. So we have a very deep and broad body of law under which actions can be brought in the WTO. But in general terms, we have the so-called trade remedy cases and then the non-trade remedy cases. And the trade remedy cases would be the dumping, anti-dumping cases, the subsidy countervail cases, or the safeguard cases. And then the non-trade remedy cases would be everything else. As I said at the outset, the Legal Affairs Division is responsible for panel composition and panel assistance on all the non-trade remedy cases, and these would be anything involving any of the other WTO agreements. But primarily those cases will frequently involve claims of national treatment violations, or MFN violations under GATT 94, Article 11 violations, which is prohibition on quotas under GATT 94. Those are recurring claims under the GATT 94, and of course the defenses that are often brought to these claims are the Article 20 defenses under GATT 1994. And then with respect to the invocation of rights under other agreements, we've had five or six intellectual property cases, probably a comparable number of services cases, comparable number of agricultural cases, and then a smattering of claims that have been brought under import licensing, under customs valuation, and some of the other agreements under Article 2 of the GATT as well, violations of the Article 2 or the tariff binding provisions and the associated provisions under Article 2. But about half of all cases that go into litigation in the WTO, a little more than half were the so-called non-trade remedy cases, and a little less than half have been trade remedy cases. If in the past, if the trade remedy cases have been more than the non-trade remedy cases, and our trade remedy colleagues in the Rules Division need some legal assistance, we have some trade remedy specialists also in Legal Affairs Division that I will make available to work on those trade remedy cases. For example, the massive steel safeguards case was handled out of our division back in 2002. Since we haven't had too many safeguard cases in the interim, we haven't been involved too much on our side in trade remedy cases more recently, although in the Airbus and Boeing cases, those cases are so massive and require so much legal assistance to the panels that I've made some of my lawyers available for specific issues that have arisen under those cases. Now, who are the adjudicators? I've talked about panel composition a bit and how that operates. It's interesting to note that of the 142 panels that we've had to date, we've had 210 different individuals from 49 different countries that have served as panels. Frequently, the parties, when they give their desired criteria for panelist backgrounds to the Secretariat, they will ask that one or two of the panelists have prior panel experience. So once you've been on a panel, oftentimes you're asked to serve again because the parties themselves like to have one or two of the panelists with prior panel experience. But nonetheless, we've had a broad cross-section of individuals from, as I say, 49 different countries that have served as adjudicators in the system at the panel level, which is rather an impressive number when you think about it over time. Panelists cannot have, of course, the same nationality of the parties to the dispute. And if countries are third parties to dispute, oftentimes the parties to a dispute will not want nationals from third parties. So what happens as a result of that, because the U.S. and the community are so frequently litigating, you will have very few Americans or very few Europeans now that serve as panelists. What you do have, and if you look at the countries that have provided the largest number of panelists to date, is you have a lot of New Zealanders that serve on panels. You have a lot of Canadians, a lot of Swiss, a lot of Australians. And then from the developing world, we've had a lot of Chileans. We've had a number of Brazilians, Indians. But the frequency with which you'll see a particular country as the country of the panelists will depend on the extent to which their country actually is involved in litigation, because if their country is involved in litigation, that pretty much disqualifies them. I think today, just, you know, out of the 210 individuals that have served on panels, I think we've only had 10 Americans that have served, for example. So, there have probably been 25 Europeans, but as the European community has expanded its membership over the past 15 years or so, previously we had a number of East Europeans that would serve as panelists, particularly in trade remedy cases. The former head of the Rules Division was Polish, and he had a network of contacts in Eastern Europe that he would draw on to staff rules panels. He's since retired, but it doesn't matter because East Europeans now are pretty much eliminated from becoming panelists because they're members of the European community. On the appellate body, to date, as you know, the appellate body has 7 individuals who serve 4-year terms were renewable once. So far we've had 19 different individuals who have served on the appellate body from 9 different countries. With the announcement yesterday, I think we will have a Mexican serving on the appellate body for the first time, and we'll have a Belgian serving on the appellate body for the first time. Those terms will begin, I guess the term of the Mexican will begin on the 1st of July, and the term of the Belgian, who is replacing Sacerdoti, who's the Italian on the appellate body now, I think that begins in December. As I said, with respect to the rate of compliance by our members with adverse decisions, it's been relatively good, but not without problems. What happens is, particularly in the case of the United States, is, and the United States, by the way, has lost about 35 cases in the WTO. The community's lost about 17 cases in the WTO. No other WTO member has lost more than 8 cases in the WTO. So, you know, it's not surprising that the U.S. and the community have lost the most cases because they've been sued most frequently. The U.S., you know, has been a defendant in 1 out of every 3 cases. So, not surprising that it's lost the most. By the way, just in terms of percentages, about 90% of the time that cases go into litigation in the WTO, 1 or more WTO violations are found. So, countries don't go into litigation as a complaining party unless they're reasonably certain that they have a solid case that they're going to win on. And the 15, almost 15 years experience proves that out. There have been a very high percentage of successful cases in the WTO. Now, they may not win on all claims, but they'll win, on some claims, at least 90% of the time. Occasionally, we'll have cases, but very rarely, where the responding party will be completely absolved in a case. So when the losing party then is asked to bring itself into conformity, they have a reasonable period of time, and of course there can be a negotiation between the parties over what that period of time should be. The DSU suggests it should not exceed more than 15 months, and that matter can be litigated as well. The reasonable period of time can be litigated. Now, that arbitration is done. The practice evolved that arbitration would be done by a single appellate body member. And, you know, we've had appellate body members in those so-called 21-3 arbitrations. There have been maybe 30 of those. You know, the reasonable period of time that they've given has varied anywhere between 6 and 15 months. So there's no, depends on the circumstances of the case. But in any event, with respect to how easy it is for countries to comply, it depends on their legal systems, of course, and the nature of the action that has been challenged, whether it's a law or an administrative action. In the case of the United States, where the United States can comply with WTO findings administratively. They have been almost perfect in their record of complying with adverse WTO findings. Where it gets difficult for the United States is when they have to go to Congress and get the underlying law changed. Because there is no expedited congressional procedure for changing U.S. law in response to adverse WTO decisions, they have to go through regular legislative procedures there, and that can be a very difficult process indeed. And for that reason, the U.S. has not been able to comply in several cases because the administration, the past administration or the current administration, has not been able to get the Congress to change the underlying law. That continues to be the case, for example, in the Havana Club trademark dispute, the Irish sound recordings dispute, a dumping case Japan brought back in the early 2000s, hot rolled steel, where there needed to be a remedial law passed to bring the U.S. in compliance, and the Congress is just not, the administration has just not been able to achieve that. Now, it's very frustrating, of course, for the winning party when they're blocked by the U.S. Congress. But that being said, I think one of the most significant things that happened in WTO dispute settlement was the fact that the U.S. Congress actually has passed four pieces of remedial legislation in response to adverse WTO rulings in 2004-2005. And this was really, from my estimation, it was really a watershed event in terms of giving additional legitimacy to WTO dispute settlement, because the U.S. Congress passed changes in U.S. law in response to adverse WTO findings. That was in the Fisk case, the Byrd Amendment case that I mentioned earlier, the 1916 Dumping Act, and also in the cotton subsidies case, where the Congress actually passed a law to eliminate a certain export subsidy program, but that didn't resolve the dispute entirely, as we know. With respect to, given the time here, I'm going to wrap up. With respect to our current level of activity, as I was mentioning to Padilla before the session started, since I've been at the WTO and since 2002, we've had a very constant flow of dispute settlement activity coming through the WTO. Right now, we have about 14 different disputes that are in the consultation phase, covering 11 different matters. We've got 7 panels in operation. We've got 2 panels that are in composition. We've got 1 arbitration, the cotton subsidies arbitration, that is in operation, and there is currently 1 appeal underway. Last year, the appellate body had a very active year. This year, the appellate body will be less active. It tends to be cyclical with the appellate body. In terms of the trends that I've seen in dispute settlement, if you measure the first 10 years versus the last 4 years, the trends that I have seen in dispute settlement are that overall we have, on a yearly basis, a lower number of disputes that are being brought into the WTO. In the first 10 years, we had an average of 30 or so disputes initiated in the WTO. In the last 4 years, we've had an average of maybe 17. Now, I won't go into the explanation for that, but I just wanted to point that trend out. But what you see is a higher percentage of disputes that are initiated in the WTO now actually go into litigation than was previously the case. You see a higher percentage of matters going to compliance panels. The number of appeals, the percentage of appeals, has been fairly constant throughout the entire period at around 70%. Of course, in recent years, one of the big developments has been the involvement of China in dispute settlement. initially as a responding party, but now China is bringing its own cases. It's brought two cases against the United States, or three cases against the United States. We've also had a trend toward open hearings since 2005, where we broadcast simultaneously, not on the internet, but in Geneva, for the public dispute settlement proceedings. This started out at the panel level, and it was extended last year to the appellate level. There were five appellate proceedings last year that were televised via simulcast at the Secretariat. Now, the dispute settlement proceedings only get simulcast by mutual consent of the parties. So if one of the parties objects, it won't be broadcast. And so far, the trend has been that now the U.S. and the community asked that every proceeding be simulcast. Other developed countries are following suit. Developing countries are more reluctant to have dispute settlement proceedings simulcast, so there's still resistance by a number of developing countries to that, although some of the developing countries now are actually agreeing to simulcast of their proceedings. Litigation in the WTO in some of these cases has become very fact-intensive, which has created huge records, and it's also created operational problems for the Secretariat in terms of how we protect business confidential information. The record in the Airbus and Boeing cases is just huge. I mean, I'm actually recused from that case, those cases. But from what I understand, you know, the record could fill up this room. There's so much documentation in that case. The Cotton case. I remember the Cotton case, which we staffed. The record went from one wall to the other. I mean, it was a huge record. So these are complex litigations. I mean, there have been criticisms that panel reports in the WTO are too long and too cumbersome. Well, one of the reasons is that, you know, those panel reports just merely reflect the record and the fact that the parties want all their arguments to be reflected in these panel reports. So it's a problem in making as much material available ex post facto for the public in these proceedings from the standpoint of translation, because we can only issue documents in all three official languages, and as the records have become longer and panel reports have become longer, we have major translation problems. But I won't go into that. That's our problem. No, it's the members' problem. They've got to pay for it. We've got, you know, some additional compliance concerns that have cropped up recently, in addition to the three U.S. cases I've talked about, particularly the U.S.-Canada-Argentine case against the Europeans on GMOs, a very difficult issue for the Europeans to manage. Right now, the Brazilian tires case, the Brazilians are having to await certain proceedings to conclude in the Supreme Court, which makes it difficult for them to finally resolve their differences with the community in that case. As I said, we've got ongoing negotiations going in that more than decade-long dispute on bananas. A bright spot recently was the conclusion of at least an initial agreement in the beef hormones case between the U.S. and the community, which is beginning, promised to resolve that case bilaterally, but the problem there is that it's got potentially adverse implications for other beef exporters of the community. So the resolution of one dispute may spawn the initiation of some other disputes. But so goes life in the WTO. All right. What does that mean? Well, you know, there may be continue to be work for either WTO lawyers or aspiring WTO lawyers. Maybe I should stop there, and we can.
Can I ask you to say, if you mentioned about the division between the United States and the Europeans, between the rule-based and the more member-driven approaches, and you said you may come back to that. I was wondering, especially because our perception is that the United States initially with the Uruguayan was the one that was for the rule-based and more, and so there has been a switch, but probably because of all the losses that you mentioned.
Maybe. Yeah.
So where do you see that going, and do you...
Where do I see it going?
In terms of the form of the dispute settlement
when
as well.
What is it? The irresistible force meets the immovable object. So what happens then? Impasse?
Nothing. Okay.
I mean,
for the time being.
I mean, the community in these DSU negotiations, I mean, you know, for the last 10 years, we've had ongoing negotiations to clarify and improve the dispute settlement understanding, and there have been numerous proposals. There are 27 articles to the DSU. There have been proposals to change 23 of those 27 articles. Initially, the community put forward a proposal to have permanent panelists at the level. So that's what I consider to be a more judicialization of the process, not the ad hoc panel process. That particular proposal by the community to have a permanent roster of panelists was not well received, not only by the U.S. but a number of other countries. So the community is revising and over time softening that proposal. In the meantime, you had some of these decisions that provoked great criticism in the U.S., particularly on zeroing. And as a result, I think of some of those decisions coming out of the appellate body on zeroing, the Bush administration, because the criticism was of a bipartisan nature here, that jurisprudence, the Bush administration felt it had to do something to respond. And so it came forward with some proposals several years ago in the dispute settlement negotiations to give additional member control over the process. And those proposals included such things as having an interim report from the appellate body like we have at the panel level, partial adoption of appellate body reports, a series of things in which, you know, you go away from a truly judicial system to something, in effect, at the appellate level, would be similar to what you have at the panel level, which tends to be more ad hoc. You know, at the appellate level, we have one uniform set of procedures for all proceedings, etc. But, you know, I don't, you know, in the dispute settlement negotiations, which will probably only conclude, even though it's not part of the single undertaking of the Doha round, simultaneously with the Doha round for political reasons, I think any changes to the dispute settlement understanding will be modest. But, you know, that being said, you know, the way the system operates now is not bad. You know, but, you know, not without concerns on a lot of different fronts. I mean, we haven't talked about, you know, the developing country concerns and the fact that the developing countries don't feel that, you know, the system as currently structured is nearly as effective for them as it could be, because the retaliation model really doesn't leave them a whole lot of leverage against the big players. We'll see what happens in the Brazil cotton case.
Right. Yeah.
That will be a very interesting case to see how that plays out.
Before we open to everyone, I have a quick question, and who may not require a simple answer, but I'll take a crack of it. And if anyone can put any light into it, it's you. So, I'm going to take this opportunity to make that question to you.
Okay.
And it has to do with zeroing. I don't recall the whole history of WTO, a practice in which has been the subject of so many panels. And my question is, what can so many, we know what the controversy is, and and we know it's one of those examples you mentioned of one being frustrating with because it's something that U.S. Congress needs to change and approve. So
actually, the U.S. Congress doesn't need to change the zeroing law, the underlying law.
It's administrative.
Yeah.
So that's even worse. So I mean, from the point of view of the question I have to make, I see how much does the quantity of cases help solve this question? I mean, if you look at the terms of reference of each case, each one looks at a particular aspect, but there is intersection. There are intersections there of arguments. So my question is: does it help bring another case to resolve the issue, or should we work with the issues that are there and go into a frustrating stage like retaliation that we know it doesn't work for the practice of having, for the purpose of having?
Well, you don't know if it does or not. You know, now you don't know if it would work in this particular case or not. In previous cases, the Europeans feel, for example, in the Byrd case, in the Fisk case, that their beginning to implement retaliation did have an impact on the political process here. You know, because it set in motion countervailing political forces. Now, you know, that's the Europeans, you know, feel that retaliation in that case did contribute to a political dynamic here that ultimately led to repeal of Byrd and repeal of Fisk. Now, you know, I have no basis on which to judge if that's true or not, but at least there's a perception on the part of a good deal of Europeans that it did contribute positively to the process. Aloisi, you've been around Washington longer than I have, and I've been around here since 75. Well, about the same time. You know, you're a student of the political process here, so you're asking me a question that you yourself are probably just as capable of providing an opinion on as me.
I want to hear yours.
Look, the zeroing, this is off the record, right? There are no reporters here, right?
No.
Okay. The zeroing, how would one describe this? Conundrum. The zeroing conundrum is the Achilles heel right now of the WTO dispute settlement process, in the sense that it's generated such a backlash politically here in Washington that it threatens to undermine the legitimacy of the dispute settlement system here in Washington. Now, you know, that would be not good given the fact that, you know, the U.S. is so heavily involved in dispute settlement, both as a complaining party and as a responding party. If, you know, this is a real challenge for the administration, and they don't, you know, it was a real challenge for the Bush administration. The Obama administration, you know, is just beginning to face this challenge as they get their team in place. You know, nobody has any simple answers on this one. And, you know, maybe it only gets resolved ultimately, as some disputes have in the past, as part of the Doha round, or as in the past, you know, in the context of an implementing bill for a big trade round. You recall how the Brazilian footwear countervailing duty case was ultimately resolved after many years. We stuck a provision
over 10 years.
We stuck a provision in the implementing bill for the Uruguay round, which finally resolved that problem.
It came out of the miscellaneous trade bill,
No, it wasn't the miscellaneous trade bill. It was in the Uruguay round implementing bill, where the countervailing duties, $200 million worth of countervailing duties on Brazilian footwear were refunded.
It took that long, then.
It was part of a fast-track bill, and that dispute had nothing to do with the Uruguay round, but that's where it was finally resolved. I don't know, if there were an easy answer to this one, but all I can say is it's a huge problem.
Well, the reason I mentioned Congress is because, there are some bills going around.
There are always bills going around
Congress. They want to make zeroing legislative.
To make it mandatory.
Exactly.
Right.
So it will make it even more difficult if that happens to get through. Anyways, let's open for questions.
You asked the really tough question at the outset, for which there's no answer.
Yeah. Please.
Just to relate to that in a way, maybe a more politically dangerous problem, because it's more understandable than zeroing, is...
Do you want to introduce yourself?
I'm Mike Lowry. I was the president of the National Trade and Investment Society. I think Barney Frank is dealing with some legislation now, trying to rectify the fact that you can gamble on animals with four legs and you can't seem to gamble on people or anything with two legs.
Mm-hmm.
It seems a little arbitrary, but it seems like that might be a tipping point in the U.S. understanding of how the WTO works, and how the dispute settlement affects legislation and the sovereignty of the United States. I was curious how the Legal Affairs Division, if they work with Congress at all, to help, I know you don't do a public relations campaign, but do you look at these issues and how the U.S. public is going to perceive them and try to address those issues at all? Because it seems right now that the Barney Frank is probably fighting a losing battle, it seems like, because there's so many interest groups that would prefer, not to have gambling brought down for an international institution like the WTO, just for sovereignty reasons alone. Is there any role for the WTO?
Not in the legislative process here. I mean, the people from the WTO, when I come to Washington, I meet with congressional staff. We encourage congressional staff to come to Geneva to interact with the institution, interact with the members over there. So, there is a dialogue that goes on in general about what's going on in the respective institutions. But, the WTO Secretariat certainly has no role in what the legislative process here will be.
Well, as a facilitating act, to inform the congressmen of what the obligations they've agreed to are, and how things would play
that's
out.
That's first of all, the Secretariat doesn't interpret the members' obligations. It's the members themselves that interpret their obligations, and they have a dispute settlement mechanism to assist them. But, for example, the Legal Affairs Division never gives a legal opinion on anything to any of our members unless it's requested on behalf of all of our members. So we never opine legally on anything. Now, occasionally, there'll be a joint request from all the members. So, but it's not, that's not our role. The members have to interpret their own obligations in light of dispute settlement decisions, and then they have to work within their own systems. Every national system is a bit different politically and legislatively. So it's the members' responsibility to do that however they best see fit. Now, the one thing I would say about Barney Frank and his efforts to repeal the Unlawful Gambling Enforcement Act. That act, and for, you know, the way Congress operates is can be strange in terms of how legislation gets passed, but, you know, we know that act didn't get enacted through regular process. It was tacked on an appropriations bill. The Byrd Amendment didn't get enacted under regular process. It was tacked on an appropriations bill. Well, now, if you can tack on the if you can attack such a bill like that under an appropriations bill, why can't you tack on a repeal of that act in an appropriations bill? I mean, going through regular process on something like that, you may be right. It may not be possible, but there are strange ways that things happen up on Capitol Hill that enact laws. And the enactment of that law, if it had gone through regular process, probably would have never been enacted in law in the first place, just like the Byrd Amendment would have never been enacted in law in the first place. So,
but if a congressman were to call your office and ask for advice on how to implement it in a way that would be complying with the interpretation of the appellate body, would that be something you'd be allowed to do or not? If an individual congressman were to call,
depends on who the congressman is.
We cannot hear what you're saying.
Well, I doubt the call will happen.
But usually, I can assure you, we don't get calls from congressional offices. I mean, what they will do is they'll call USDR. They won't call the they'll call the administration. They won't call us.
Yes, my name is Salvador Ramirez from Mexico, and I'd like to know what you think about the possibility from the appellate body right now to emigrate into a judicial, well-established appellate body in the future.
You mean to a permanent employees, yes, of the WTO instead of being these...
To permanent employees instead of, with lifetime appointments?
Or, because you tell that they are elected every 4 years.
4 years. They can serve for 4 years, renewable once, so they can serve 8 years.
Is it a permanent basis?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do you think there could be an improvement in the way the appellate body functions at this moment?
Improvement in the way the appellate body functions. I'm trying to think if any of the members have proposed. There have been some proposals in the context of DSU negotiations to expand the number of appellate body members from 7 to 9. There have been some proposals to expand the time period for the appellate body to render decisions. Right now, they're asked to render decisions within 90 days. That's a very, very tight time frame, particularly since effectively they have to have their decision written within 75 days because they have to allow 15 days for translation. I think the appellate body, and certainly the appellate body secretariat, would like to have a longer period of time to carry out the appellate process, at least 120 days, probably, you know, if it were up to them, maybe 150. So probably the thing that could most improve the appellate body process right now would be to extend the time period within which they have to render their decision, because, you know, that's a very tight time frame, particularly if they have simultaneous appeals. If they have more than two appeals going at the same time, they're just overwhelmed. They really can't handle more than two appeals simultaneously. It's what it amounts to. So, you know, but as I was saying, you know, their work tends to be cyclical. Last year they had 8 appellate proceedings covering 13 different disputes. They were working literally full time around the clock. But this year, you know, which would have said, well, if last year if they would have had nine rather than 7 members, they probably could have used 9 members last year. But this year they'll have maybe 3 appeals the whole year. They probably don't even need 7 members this year. So, you know, the appellate work tends to be somewhat cyclical in terms of, you know, the intensity with which they have to operate. But I think, you know, I think the extension of the time period from 90 to 100 days would help them immensely.
I think one other thing that Peter Vandenbosch actually always argued for is permanent employees. to be not part-time, to have them as permanent. But with all the benefits that WTO and
Employment. Yeah, and there have been, you know, the appellate body members themselves have approached the members on that. Mm-hmm. And the members are not persuaded yet. Now, the members are not persuaded. There are budgetary implications to that the members are not, budgetary obligations the members are not willing to undertake. But, appellate body members, when they join the appellate body, they take an oath that they will make themselves available on short notice. And effectively, it means unless they're teachers, they can't do anything else. They've got conflict problems as well. I mean, some of the early appellate body members tried to maintain separate law practices and found it was impossible.
Are they well paid?
The appellate body members they get paid a retainer of, I think it's around 8,000 Swiss francs a month. So they're paid a retainer of 100,000 Swiss francs a year, and then they're paid for every day they work 680 Swiss francs a day, which is not very much, in terms of the daily fee. But that's in addition to the retainer, and then of course they get their travel and lodging expenses. By Washington law firm standards, they're not paid very well. But I mean, it's a part-time job.
Yeah. Hi, my name is Jorge Huerta. I'm an LLM student from Uruguay, and I have two questions: one procedural and one substantive question. The procedural question is regarding an issue where developed and developing countries collide. It's regarding the legality and utility of the amicus curiae briefs presented to the appellate body with facts and issues. And my substantive question is has to do with the zero in question. Mutatis mutandi to the U.S. subsidy policy. If shall Brazil or, for example, another developing country as Uruguay present new cases against the subsidy policy of the United States in the development and the dispute settlement mechanism, or fight that war in the Doha round, where the last paper of Falconer does not help very much and only attack the water that the United States has to make subsidies? Which is the best field to play?
What's the question on? Is there a question there with?
If Uruguay or developing countries shall present new cases against?
Would litigation help negotiate?
To go to litigate, or does affect the?
I understand. Well, with respect to amicus curiae.
Ruth, can you please repeat the question for us in the conference call? We couldn't understand what you said.
Okay, well, the first question is on amicus curiae briefs and to the extent to which they are used and have any impact on the litigation process. Amicus curiae briefs are, by default, they are allowed. They're not prohibited within the WTO dispute settlement process. We have amicus curiae briefs that are submitted to panels and the appellate body, but so far there's probably never been an instance where an amicus curiae brief had any impact on a decision one way or another. And at least at the panel level, sometimes panelists will look at them, sometimes they won't. Now, the use of amicus curiae is very controversial with some developing countries because they feel that it imposes additional burdens on them to litigate because they have to respond to arguments that are presented if they're brought before them. And when they joined the dispute settlement understanding, this was a government-to-government proceeding, and there was no reference to amicus curiae, and the only arguments they felt that they would have to contend with are those that were brought by the other side. So, one of the proposals by some developing countries in the dispute settlement negotiations is to prohibit the use of amicus curiae, so they don't even have to worry about it. But as a practical matter, they really had no impact on the decision-making process to date. Now, the second question from our Uruguayan colleague here was, would, and I'm paraphrasing, would additional litigation against U.S. or European agricultural subsidies facilitate an outcome on agricultural subsidies in the Doha round? Is that a fair restatement of the question?
Yes.
Okay. Well, we've in early 2008, the Canadians and the Brazilians initiated a dispute settlement case against the U.S. on U.S. subsidy program, ag subsidy programs. A panel was established. We went into panel composition. We had three or four meetings among the parties, and then Brazil and Canada, for whatever reason, decided to suspend the proceeding. And one probably had to do with the fact that there was an intensification of the negotiations in 2008 on the Doha round, including on agriculture. And two, in the intervening time, the U.S. Congress passed a new farm bill, which altered the farm program. So what the previous case was on the 2002 farm bill. So the, you know, the underlying legislation had been changed. Now, the problem I think that countries have in bringing cases against U.S. agricultural subsidies is, of course, they have to look at the particular subsidy in relation to what U.S. obligations are under the Uruguay round agreements, and the U.S. obligations are fairly generous. As you say, there's a lot of water between what their overall commitments are and individual programs as applied. So they can always bring serious prejudice cases like Brazil did in cotton, but you know, those are those cases depend really on the commodity in question, what the market prices are, and how they trigger the U.S. questions, the programs in question.
I was thinking specifically in rice, because in rice, have that case against
yeah, that's right, yeah, rice. On rice subsidies.
But nowadays the international price is up, so Uruguay cannot prove the damage.
On serious prices, yeah.
But when the price down will fall again, like it's a cyclical evolution of the prices.
Yeah.
Uruguay could have a very good, solid case against U.S. subsidies.
Well, I can't comment on if Uruguay would have a solid case or not, but certainly one of the reasons that the Brazilians won the serious prejudice in cotton, which was the first time a serious prejudice case was ever brought and litigated, was because cotton prices were so depressed, and they continue to be depressed, whereas most other commodity prices in recent years have been very high by historic terms.
There was a soybean case that Brazil was preparing that decided not to file because prices had gone up. Yeah. That happens.
Yeah.
Any questions from the phone?
I think we're okay. Thank you.
No questions there?
No.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Oh, sorry. Oh, okay. Yeah, my name is Paul Scarborough, and I had a question. I read in the international press, in The Economist, and in other media, some very vague references to some slight rise in protectionism around the world because of the current downturn. And I was wondering, I'm sorry, if you know, in the WTO, if you had actually seen any rise in the disputes in relation to that, or is that just
Yeah, did you hear the question in Brazil? The question was whether or not the economic crisis, which has led to a contraction of trade, has led to new dispute settlement cases in the WTO as a result of measures, potentially protections measures having been taken. And my answer, well, first of all, let me just say that over the last 6 or 8 months, really the mission of the WTO, the focus of the mission has shifted from trade liberalization through the Doha round to containment of protectionism through the monitoring mechanisms that have been put in place. The Director General began this initiative last fall. He's issued several reports. Those reports, which were reports of new measures, trade measures that had been taken by the members, those reports were encouraged and, in fact, mandated by the G20 to continue. So we've got new mechanisms in place in the WTO to try to help contain through the spread of protectionism. And I think generally the silver lining in the dark cloud of the current economic recession from a WTO perspective is that for so many years, the value of the WTO was measured through the success or failure of the Doha round, whereas the real value of the WTO is the institutional and legal basis for the trading system as it came out of the Uruguay round, both in terms of the body of law and the institution. And I think there has been a greater appreciation now of how valuable the WTO is, even in the absence of the conclusion of the Doha round. Now, that's not to say that what could be achieved through the Doha round would not be of further benefit for the members, but I think there was a lack of appreciation, particularly in the business press, as to, you know, well, if the Doha round doesn't succeed, what good is this institution? And I think, in hard times, the value of the WTO has been reaffirmed. And I think the economic writers are appreciating that around the world, and they didn't appreciate that before. In terms of the impact on dispute settlement cases, we haven't really seen any uptick in dispute settlement cases. Last year there were 19 cases brought to the WTO. The 4-year average had been like 17 cases. This year to date, we've only had 5 cases brought to the WTO. So there's not been any noticeable change in the normal dispute settlement activity. Now, that's not to say it might not happen if members are perceived to be violating their WTO obligation, but so far we haven't seen it.
You mentioned that the developing countries sometimes feel that retaliation is not the most adequate result from the process. So, which I completely agree. So, do you think that in those scenarios, could the process be moving towards compensation or even towards a third option that we don't know?
When you say compensation, you mean what kind of compensation?
Compensation within the WTO.
Within the WTO framework. There have been some suggestions that we should try to improve the compensation process so that developing countries would get liberalization in another area as compensation for non-compliance. But so far, of course, those will not be agreed in isolation. It will be, if anything happens there, it will be part of an overall outcome on the dispute settlement understanding that, well, in turn, only, in my view, and the conventional wisdom is, only take place if there's a successful conclusion of the Doha round. So, possibly. But, of course, the most important thing, ultimately, is compliance with one's obligations. And compensation, retaliation are second and third best outcomes. I mean, the best outcome is for countries to bring themselves into compliance.
my opinion, WTO visa settlement system is not a very effective system. It's not very good.
Just back up a little bit.
Sorry.
Well, I'll repeat it. Okay, go ahead.
The enforcement system of WTO visa settlement system is not so good, in my opinion. The retaliation. In the past, when Japan raised their import tax system of China's some industry of China, China can just increase the import tax of some Japanese product, right? Japanese maybe in the machine industry, and we increase your import tax in your agricultural product. That's a kind of retaliation. We don't have to go through the WTO dispute system to increase the import tax. And for United States, and I think the United States Congress passed some regulation to restrict the industry of other countries. But the defending party of WTO dispute settlement system is the U.S. administration, that is U.S. government. So if other country win those cases, how can we enforce in United States? I'm just being curious about it, because the defending party is U.S. administrative, U.S. government. If WTO reach a decision that the U.S. government is wrong in those cases, it's the U.S. government who lose the cases.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, I mean, if the U.S. loses a case in the WTO that requires a change in U.S. law, the administration goes to the Congress and tries to get the Congress to pass remedial legislation. And as I said earlier, the U.S. administration has succeeded in doing that in four different occasions. In some cases, they still have not succeeded in doing that. So, from that standpoint, the system has not worked perfectly, that's for sure. But a lot of the cases that the U.S. government has lost have been cases that they have been able to comply with by changing administrative practice. In fact, the majority of the cases have involved administrative measures rather than U.S. laws, and the U.S. has brought itself into compliance one way or the other. The WTO system is not perfect. I mean, these are agreements between sovereign nations. They entail rights and obligations. You mentioned the example of China and Japan. Well, I don't know the particulars of that case, but you said, well, China could just retaliate by raising tariffs against Japanese without going to the WTO. Well, you know, if China and Japan in their bilateral relations choose to both ignore their WTO obligations, I mean, I guess that's their decision. But most countries, when they entered into the WTO, they have, in good faith, agreed to comply with their obligations under the WTO. And I think, as a practical matter, governments try to comply with their international obligations. All governments try to comply with their international obligations. So is the system perfect? No. But is the system reasonably effective given all the other considerations? So far, I think yes. That's why this is a fascinating field. You know, international legal judgments are not self-executing. It's not like a court judgment you get out of the domestic court where you can get somebody to either be put into jail or get, you know, an action taken to garnish somebody else's wages, or there are other mechanisms at the domestic level. There are very few mechanisms in relations between countries in terms of how countries can react to each other legally within the international legal context. But that's why you're getting your LLM, to figure out how best to do it, I guess.
International.
What's important to note also is that the system you have today is not perfect. Far from it. But it's so much better than what we had before 1995. Before, one country could block a report. You won't be able to read it. So it's, we're going in the right direction, and you're right, you know, the system is not perfect, and until it's going to be very difficult to come up with a mechanism that would obligate countries to comply without discussion, and you know, Congresses to lose their power. It's just at this point unthinkable. So it's going to be a hard road, but we hope that with people like you working, you know, in the profession, will help solve that problem in the future.
You can go back and help China implement its its the cases it's lost recently in the WTO.
In China's report, it's very interesting. I would think that recently there is a case between U.S. and China. IP,
right.
Property.
Right.
In the U.S. press, in the U.S. report press, the U.S. said, yeah, we win the case. But in China's press, we think we win the case.
Yeah.
Because they're different.
It's all relative.
Well, it's not, you know, different in China than any other country.
You know something? You know something? China and the U.S. were both right. They both won that case in certain aspects. It's just what they emphasized to their own public, which part of the case they emphasized. The part that they won, not the part that they lost.
Well, let's...
Not yet. I have a question.
You have a question.
I have a question. It's a pity that so many people left, but my question is not on substantive law, and it's the same question I asked you when I was just working for Macquarie University and we had the WITA event, which is, for the students who want to be interns and learn from you, what is the procedure? Talk a little bit, if you could please, about jobs at the WTO, internships at the WTO, where to get started, and your advice career-wise for those who want to follow your path.
Well, the WTO internship program, you can apply online. We have a website there.
Is there anything they can do to make their applications a little more attractive? Because the website is pretty, yeah. I remember.
Attach $100
bill. It's pretty much when I was a student and I would go and apply on the website, and it's me and a million others.
And
so just this is off the record.
Copy Maria Pereira. She's our intern coordinator in legal affairs. Maria Pereira.
And she doesn't like U.S. resumes. She likes long European-style CVs, because I spoke to her, and she does not like resumes. She's like, don't come with the short stuff, because I want the long one.
And Maria is, she's our intern coordinator, legal affairs division, and she will call you up. She'll check your transcript. She'll read your writings. She does an excellent job in terms of selecting interns. We have three legal interns in legal affairs every 4 months, so we have 9 legal interns a year. And sometimes, if they are assigned to a case and they do a good job on a case, they continue as a contract lawyer to do that case. But there are other, the appellate body hires, I think, 2 interns. I think they hire 2 interns every 3 months, so they have 8 intern positions a year. And then the other divisions, the practice varies. The rules division is, I think, under new leadership, and I think they're going to start hiring more interns now than they have in the past. So the opportunities are there. Because we have 153 different members, we try to spread the internships around by nationality. And so we're always, so we've got diverse, I mean, since I've been Director of Legal Affairs, we've had probably around 55 different interns, maybe from 35 different countries.
Have you had an Uruguayan yet?
No.
Not yet. Okay, good.
We have a.
We actually, by the former Julio Lacarte Muro.
We actually have a Uruguayan panelist now. Not Julio Lacarte. He chaired the China Auto Parts panel. What his most recent panel after he left the appellate body.
So another question. I'm sorry to bug you so much with this, but you are on the spot already, so I'm not putting you on the spot. When they fill out the form online and everything, the application containing letters of recommendations from professors, from previous supervisors, does that help?
Yes.
Does the WTO look at that?
Yes, sure.
Okay, that makes more
sense. We look at, Maria looks at everything.
Okay.
Yeah, no, definitely.
And maybe let's talk, and then in terms of permanent employee, what's the kind of experience? Do you require like 5 years of experience like other places do, or?
Yes, but it depends on what level. For entry level, now this is changing under the Lamy regime. I think they're going to be hiring at a lower level with less experience in some cases. But, you know, there are not that many legal positions that become available in the WTO, so you have to be realistic about this. The best thing, my advice to you is to go get experience in a national administration or a national law firm. Don't think you can come and work at the WTO before you've worked at the national level. It happens sometimes, but you'll be a better professional over the longer term if you get national experience. So my strong recommendation would go back to your countries and get national experience in your own administrations, in your own system. And then if you want to make a switch to the international civil service, at that point do it. But you'll be much better off if you get experience within your own national system. And the secretariat will be better off if you have that experience as well.
Thank you so much.
Okay.
Well, Pagde, you want to say something to close?
I want to thank you very much for taking the time. I want to thank
Fabrizio
for allowing us to have this session here and for inviting you. And I want to thank all of you who came. You see, we have very... And if this was not after school and after graduation, we would have had to have a much bigger room. We have 300 students interested.
Well, I'm glad it was after school and after...
that's why I was doing I'm telling you that a lot of students are disappointed that they'll find out that this has happened, that they haven't been around. But this was, we just had graduation last weekend, and that's people are off.
Students who follow the podcast would be podcasted, so this would be available as well.
Okay. Well, good luck to all of you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
And let me just say that this is a fascinating area to work in. I mean, after all these years, Aloysio and I still get excited when we go to the office. So, you know, it must be interesting.
It's got to be good.
And we hope you come back.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you all. Bye-bye, Rio, Belo Horizonte, São Paulo.
Oh, thank you very much, Luiz. Thank you, Bruce.
Okay.
Bye. Bye.